like to have there. Mr. Nairn, how many states now have negative fund balances?
I can give you an approximation. There are approximately 30 who are borrowing or are expected to borrow in the very near future.
Okay. And if a state borrows from the federal government for its funds, how long do you have to pay that back before you begin paying interest?
If it's repaid, and I'm trying to remember, Representative Leek, because I have not been following this that closely, because I hadn't, hopefully would not get in that situation. But as I recall, if you borrow after January 1st of a year, and if you repay that loan by, I believe it's September the 30th of the same year, then it's considered a cash flow problem, and interest is not due. However, if you borrow before January, or you cannot repay the interest by, or repay the loan by that time, then you have an interest that is the prevailing rate of interest is being accrued to the federal, to the trust fund, if in the in the federal budget, with a cap of 10%. However, the interest is now accruing at less than 10%, so it looks like it would be actual interest.
So, in other words, were we to end up in a situation next April where your predictions are off by some, what are we talking about, $50 million, and you had to borrow some small amount of money until September, there would not be any interest implication for the state whatsoever.
That's my understanding. I do not want to go on the record without bringing the information to be precise, but that's my understanding of how it would happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Is it correct that the 1981 law that changed the benefit structure, the last phase of that, it goes into place this year?
That's correct.
At what date?
In the week containing July 4th of this year.
So, in fact, the bill that passed in the last session, which gave substantial benefit increases in return for a tightening of the system, has not even taken in place. But has not even taken place before the people who supported that plan want to change the structure in effect, renege on the agreement that was made in the last session of the legislature, trade benefits for tightening of the system.
I don't know if that's a question.
That's more or less a statement. You don't have to answer that. Yeah. That's more a statement than less.
There were those of us who were not here last session,
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
We would not agree to it where we were here.
Okay, let's kind of had a, maybe we can draw to a close on the point counterpoint. Representative DeBoer had another question. Okay. Representative DeBoer.
First of all, I guess I'd like to say that I didn't necessarily tell Representative Leek that I believed their projections and had that much hope for what I saw. So, just to counterpoint you. Secondly, is I do see there is a need, so don't misunderstand what I'm driving at. If we were to go and adopt this bill, and the fund did come to a negative balance, and you had only so much time to repay, to which we would want to do to save the 10% interest. Is that correct? It's 10% now.
It would be the going rate of interest that the fund is accumulating in the federal treasury. And right now, it's a little bit less than 10%. 10% is as high as the interest can be.
Okay. And we had to raise that money quickly. How would we raise that money plus at the same time start putting our fund back into a positive cash flow?
We have to, the legislature would, if that was their, what they wish to do, they would have to increase employer taxes.
Thank you.
Okay, Ron.
Well,
refresh my memory. I think we passed.
Yeah, so the only thing I was going to mention was there was a bill passed that implementing legislation to enable us to put a surtax on employers to rate to pay the interest rate.
Well, I just wanted that in the record, though.
Okay. We've already passed one tax increase mandated by federal law. At least we have. The Senate, I think, is still chewing on it. Okay, I think that as far as members of the public, we've had an opportunity to get the positions of some of the different groups. I don't think we need any additional comment. I'm not inviting it, let's put it that way. Is there any further question or comment on the conceptual amendment, Representative Leak? And we've got a couple more amendments to discuss, so don't everybody scurry off whatever happens here. Any further comment or question on Representative Leak's amendment? Okay, if not, the clerk will call the roll.
Leak?
Aye.
Shiprock?
Aye.
Bisciotti? DeBoer?
No.
Ford?
No.
Gold?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Okay, the chair would move then to a couple other amendments proposed. One was an amendment prepared by the Employment Division dated April 11, 1983, and that dealt with whether or not people who were disqualified had much notice of if they were to find themselves in that situation or were contemplating that situation, just whether or not they really appreciated the severity of the consequences. And I think it's probably still appropriate to include that kind of notice, and I believe it. The Employment Division brought us an example of the posting or how that notice might be accomplished. And basically, that would be inserting some additional language which states that in ORS 657-260, in addition to the language which is there as far as imposting requirements, we include the sentence, the printed statement, the posting shall include notice to the workers in plain language of the potential disqualification for voluntarily leaving work or being discharged. Is that, I hope everyone's recollection is. Again, I'd ask members to maybe take a look at their file. It's an amendment to HB 2592. Prepared by the Employment Division, I think it was April 11th, 83. And again, it would insert in the relating clause 657-260 and would include the sentence that the printed statement shall include notice to the workers in plain language of the potential disqualification for voluntarily leaving work or being discharged. And the chair would move that as an additional amendment to 2592. Let me ask the Employment Division, is that my recollection or statement of the circumstances are reasonably accurate?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the one dated that date, but I have the memo that we sent over dated March 17th that exactly the same words you read, so we have the language.
Probably is that one we just used. We had.
Kurt, is there any further question or comment about that amendment to provide some additional notice to workers of the consequences if they're in a voluntary quit situation? Is there any objection to that amendment? If not, it's adopted. The next amendment include a set prepared at my request by Anita Paulson and bear the date April 14th, 1983. And this had to do with a situation apparently as a result of a court case where an individual left employment in anticipation of another job. And the other job fell through, and I think the fact situation was that a person gave notice and then left a few days before their job actually terminated with their former employer. They find out that the job that was there, that they expected to be there, that also fell through. But because these individuals left before the actually last day they could have worked, they're being disqualified. And I think Anita may have worked or talked with the Employment Division to make sure we had the language to deal with what at least I felt was a really severe penalty when a person was basically acting in good faith. And I guess the language that is proposed there, again, is found at on this letter or two-page amendment prepared by Anita Paulson. I guess the Employment Division assisted in this. Can you folks help me out a little bit more here? Is my recollection accurate so far?
Representative Springer, your recollection is accurate. We did work with Anita Paulson on the language and, in fact, drafted the language for her, per her request.
Okay, and that language is on this two-page amendment bearing the date April 14th, if you have a copy of that.
We do not have a copy of that. We have a one-page amendment dated April 14th, 1983.
It's on both sides, I think.
Okay, it's on the front and back.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't you run through the language that you helped prepare there?
Okay, Representative Springer, basically, it starts by saying that an individual has to have notified the employer that the individual leave on a specific date. So the employee must let the employer know that they are going to be quitting, and it has to be a specific date. Then we look at whether or not the reason for the separation would be for reasons which constitute good cause. So the reason that they will be leaving has to be for a reason such as to accept another job. That was the Robin Green case that went before the court. Then we look at whether that individual left work without good cause prior to the date that they would have left work for good cause. And that early leaving has to be within 30 days of the planned date of leaving. So all of those particular criteria have to be met before this bill, before this legislation would be in effect. Then if all of those things do happen, we adjudicate that particular separation as if the early leaving had not occurred and the planned leaving had occurred, and the individual then would be determined to have voluntarily left with good cause at the planned date of separation, but they would not be able to draw benefits in between the date they actually left and their planned date of leaving.
Okay, and that's, I just want to make sure we got the language in front. Is that 656.176 in parent a new sub 6 or an amended sub 6?
A new sub 6.
A new sub 6. Okay. Does everyone understand? And that's the purpose you've outlined there is just that which I intend, and I think we've got the language here as well. Is there any further discussion or comment on that amendment or the situation it seeks to address? Okay, the chair would move that amendment. The motion hadn't already been placed. Is there any objection to that amendment? Okay, if not, it's adopted. I think the original bill does not have an emergency clause. I think it's going to be probably appropriate to insert an emergency clause unless that's going to create a problem for you folks and you would like a more specific or another effective date.
No, that would be fine.
The total bill would have an emergency clause.
Representative Springer,
yes.
Is the emergency clause just to the amendment on the voluntary leaving, anticipation of voluntary leaving,
no,
or does that include
the
poster
whole,
and
the whole bill?
Okay.
I don't believe, Mr. Chairman, there'd be any way that we could possibly do the whole bill on an emergency basis. If we have to put 12, let's see.
67,000 employers.
Yeah, we've got posters to make, and we're talking about the 12 weeks I know, too. And to put that back into effect is going to take us months. We'd have to change forms. We'd have to do retraining, change a computer.
So you want the normal of 90 days after the sunny die adjournment?
As long as possible.
That would push us. That would push us on the computer program.
Okay. Representative Lee.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, I'll ask you to hold that for just a moment because the council reminds me that when we adopted my last amendment, we were talking about that quit in anticipation of a, what's the word I want to use? Well, we adopted it to quit in terms of anticipation of a...
Oh, I'm sorry, of a...
Quit.
When you just adopted it as a quit in anticipation of a quit.
Okay, now we're talking about a quit in anticipation of a discharge.
That's the other.
And that's another subsection of 176. So to be track, I think I would move that we adopt the same amendment, the same kind of language for a voluntary quit in anticipation of a discharge. Is there any objection to that amendment as well to 657.176 in parent 5?
Have they got that?
That's adopted. Representative Lee, and as far as the effective date, it's going to be 90 days after signee die for the whole shoot and match.
Subject to LC's review and preparation of the amendments, I move 2592 to the floor with a pass recommendation with the recommendation of the Attorney General.
Okay. Representative Leek moves House Bill 2592 to the floor, due pass recommendation as amended, and a further recommendation that it be printed engrossed. And with the qualification, I think that I announced earlier that since we're acting conceptually, if in the preparation of the actual language there's any hassle or hang up whatsoever, we will not hesitate to review it again in committee. And that means if you folks find a substantial problem of any kind, let us know and we'll take the appropriate action.
And we'll watch for the engrossment and work from the engrossment once it's printed.
Okay, and I might also ask our counsel and Chuck Wilson to
run it by us.
To, if there's any question in their mind, to give you a call.
Okay.
Okay, is everyone clear? Any further discussion or comment? Okay, if not, the clerk will call the roll on Representative Leek's motion.
Shipwreck?
Here. I'm reading. Yes.
DeBoer?
No.
Ford?
No.
Dole?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Leek?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Motion to adopt. Notice of minority report.
And Representative Johnson serves notice of a possible minority report.
There will be one.
Okay. Next is 2908.
2908.
Okay, as far as the last bill, Representative Leek or myself will be carrying it. It'll be on the committee report. He's actually doing it. 2908, Employment Appeals Board. Ms. Morgan, we apologize. We didn't get a chance to review in detail the briefs you left for us.
Is that what that stuff is?
I think that, is that 1 week's effort or 1 month's
effort? Two weeks effort, and that's about a normal load that we're carrying.
Do you replace your glasses about once a month?
Lots of Visine.
Okay, 2908 has to do with the Employment Appeals Board. The original bill has been substantially amended, or at least substantial amendments have been proposed, and those bear the date May 4th, 1983. We got into a discussion on this subject. We got a little hung up a few days ago. It's my understanding there may be some further amendments. There's a request for some information from members of the committee that I don't think the board had anticipated, or the Employment Division, and they may have some additional information. I think I've had a chance to talk with members of the committee who had raised some earlier questions. I want to, if I may, sort of set the ground rules. I don't want this to turn into kind of a ways and means hearing. I am aware that some members of the committee have some questions about the larger purpose or role or function of the Employment Appeals Board, and I want to allow them an opportunity briefly to speak to those questions and the amendments, if any, and then allow you folks a brief opportunity to respond, and then we'll try to move on from there as expeditiously as possible and conclude our discussion one way or the other today on this bill and its amendments.
I'd like to be clear on the status of the bill. Is this bill started, then we got May 4th, revised proposed amendments, two sets, and that's what we're really working on.
One's an engrossment and one is a set of amendments.
Oh, draft engrossment is what we're working on.
We're working on one set of amendments so far, and those have been incorporated into an engrossed version. I think each of those documents prepared with the assistance of the Employment Division. And I'm trying to look at the amendments. Though there were some questions about what they meant, particularly in the new Section 9 on page 8, I think we kind of reached an agreement there as to what the intent was for pro tem appointments. And there may be some other questions on the original amendments, but we can get to those in good time. Let me recognize Representative Leak or Hanlon. If we have some new amendments, let's go ahead and get those out so we can consider them all together.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if Council has distributed LC 2908-1.
Thank you.
Basically, they look pretty imposing because it's transition language. The effective language on this, however, is on page 5, section 12. Which says, except otherwise specifically provided in the Act does not become operative until September 1, 1985. I believe there are some serious concerns about the operation of the Employment Appeals Board at the present time. But you know, considering that we're late in the session, apparently that some changes need to be made in the operation. I'm not prepared to slow down the process or delay the necessary legislation at this time. So what I propose to do with 2908-1 is basically to sunset this board on September 1, 1985. That will allow the board to be on notice that its functions are going to be closely reviewed during the next legislative session. The amendments transition the functions of the board to the Employment Relations Board on that date, on September 1, 1985. The full review of the board's function during the next legislative session determine that it is appropriate to maintain the board in its existing form, that'll be fine. The purpose of these amendments are just to cause the next legislature to take a serious look at this board and do nothing else.
Representative Johnson,
could I ask why, in a few sentences, could you tell me what you're unhappy about? I haven't heard anything that says you have a reason to be unhappy.
The suggestion has been made.
Handle, I don't care.
Okay.
Well, I was going to say a few words, and I think they'll be in response to that.
Okay.
I think we have the testimony that the board meets once every 2 weeks and decides about 125 cases every 2 weeks. We have a budget, as I recall, of over $800,000 per biennium for the three-member board and 4.75 full-time equivalents. Positions, and you will see, I think you have in your file a memo from me from information supplied by the Employment Division that indicates the 1982 calendar year pay of the board members at an average of over $40,000 a year. We also have the testimony that at least one of the board members is employed elsewhere for what amount of time we don't know, but in essence we have a board that meets once every 2 weeks that's on their own so far as any other accounting to the overall system. I think I agree with what Representative Leek says. In essence, we're late in the session. We don't have time to go in and fully explore these things, but I do have some very, very strong concerns about this, and Representative Leek's amendments apply to the sunset and transfer the functions, if I understand them correctly, of the Employment Appeals Board to the Employment Relations Board, which, as I understand it, is a full-time, regular daily meeting board that I think we could possibly perform more economically in merging the board. So that's my say on in response to your questions and just in general.
Mr. Chair, could I ask, is your budget reviewed by the Ways and Means Committee?
Yes, yes, it is. Representative Johnson.
When was that done?
Well, I think they were working on it this last week. The agency itself carries the budget for our board.
You people carry budget as a part of yours, is that correct?
Okay, these are federal funds, correct?
Yes, they are.
No general fund dollars.
That's right.
Okay, let me ask of the proponents of the amendment, and then we'll recognize these folks. Do you gentlemen know if the Employment Relations Board has had an opportunity to respond one way or the other? Or are they aware of?
No, I do not. I believe that they are aware of the concept of the amendments. I believe that they have, that members of the board have formally expressed the fact that they could even now perhaps assume the duties of this board. So, yes, they're aware of the concept, but they're not aware that this specific amendment is being introduced today. No.
Okay, but
it's not a brand new idea being brought to them. They are aware and have had discussions in regard to this.
Okay, we're going to want to hear in some greater detail from you folks and from the Employment Division, but let me ask as a first question that I hope you can respond to at some point. Is there anything in the federal law that would prohibit the Employment Relations Board from performing the functions now performed by the Employment Appeals Board?
Mr. Chairman, I have not seen these proposed amendments until this minute. I was not aware that this was a consideration. I have no idea. I doubt if there's anything in federal law, but I cannot say one way or the other.
Okay. And why don't we go ahead with the rest of your response, and you can choose to do that however you wish.
Describe how you carry the budget, and your entire budget is reviewed by Ways and Means, as is every other budget.
Representative Johnson, our budget is reviewed by Ways and Means. We had our review of the subcommittee on Monday and Tuesday of this week, and it is at this time being reviewed by the full committee. Our budget includes the Appeals Board budget.
I see. Was there any discussion of the Appeals Board budget by any of the members?
Yes, it was raised it was revised upwards because their workload is higher.
It was revised upwards by the committee?
Yes.
Because
by the subcommittee.
By the subcommittee as a result. So it has been duly considered by them.
Yeah, it was a line item, and it was brought up as a revision to the budget through our fiscal officer. Because the workload was higher than we had anticipated when the budget was put together.
Okay. Do you know who is the fiscal analyst who works for the subcommittee on that one?
Well, our legislative fiscal analyst is Mike Stinson.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Morgan, go ahead.
Ross Morgan, Chairman of the Employment Appeals Board. I would really like to point out to the members of the committee that in 1980, and I think you folks have these figures we gave you the first day, we had 1,452 cases that year. 1981, we had 1,629. And in 1982, we had 2,530. And the board gets paid according to how many transcripts there are to read, and that is directly resulting in more money for the board. And when in 1980 the board would not have made anywhere near the amount of money that they did in 1982. And it goes up and down, and we're hopeful that this depression will get over someday, and that's why it's on a sliding scale, because it would be reduced drastically if we were to go back to the level of unemployment that we had in 1980. And so these are the figures. The only increases in this budget of any consequence at all is the fact that the agency itself was doing the transcripts up until the middle of last year. And then the board took over doing the transcripts and contracted them. And the cost that you see, the increase in the budget, is directly attributable to the fact that we now have a function we didn't have before, which is producing transcripts. And so that's what the increase is all about. And the rest of it is just pure caseload. And the number of staff that we have is exactly the same now as it was when the load was half as big. And so our people are working their tail ends off to keep up with this thing, and working a lot of time they don't get paid for, because the number of positions is exactly the same as when the load was half as big as it is now. On a basis of how we operate and the fact whether or not
looked at it lately. The number there for the benefit to the worker would come out to somewhere around 5% of the total cost. So we're looking at about a third of the total cost is benefits related directly to the wage in the way that temporary total and permanent total benefits are. So if you took a third times the 10%, you'd get around 3%. Obviously, my numbers are a little bit higher than what they came out. They came out with 1.7.
The 1.7, then, just as an example, the 1.7% increase is increase in overall comps and work overall costs in workers' compensation. And basically, the steps you took us through is what the NCCI did in coming up with these fiscal impacts.
Well, that's the model they've used in the past and okay. Evaluating all these things, and I'm assuming that they've done the same thing. It's pretty easy to follow the kind of actuarial methods that have been used and are accepted by the actuarial profession.
For the committee's information, I received this memo this morning along with the rest of us, this one dated May 12th. I also asked that SAFE take a look at what was supplied us by the Workers' Comp Department and see if they could come up with their own figures, or at least comment on whether there was any material differences with what SAFE could come up with, as opposed to these two memos we have dated May 6th and May 12th. Mr. Sutherland, can you comment on that?
Well, I took a more pragmatic method. We have the average, we have the weekly wage of the claimant that file. When I took two fiscal years and analyzed them, 78, 79, and 79, 80. And I did that because I didn't know how to access the file for more recent periods to begin with.
We need to have your name on the record.
Sutherland, Don Sutherland from SAFE.
Thank you.
And secondly, the older the fiscal year is, the more representative the data becomes, because you get the duration of the time loss paid, and the amount, of course, increases over time. And I worked up a formula that to just what Mr. Lamb explained, blew up the actual time loss paid to the limits projected by the bill. And I didn't analyze permanent total benefits because all the PTD claims aren't filed yet. It takes an average of 44 months before they hit the agency as PTD. So a lot of them are really not even established yet. So I confine myself just to time loss. I'll leave these with the committee, and I'll give you a summary of the information.
Over a beer.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Sutherland, I think one of my main questions was whether you had any material difference with what the workers' comp department got from the NCCI. Could you just take perhaps the permanent partial disability and tell us whether there's any differences there with...
Wait.
I'm sorry.
Wait. Let's not mix apples and oranges here. You were asking a question about PPD. I'd rather we just stick to 2376 before we jump ahead anywhere.
Okay.
Okay, can we just deal with one bill at a time here?
Hopefully.
Even those of us who are somewhat familiar with this stuff want to make sure that we track just on one issue at a time. So we, of course, want to consider the overall impact, but I'd rather just stick to one bill.
Mr. Chair, I think the purpose of having the testimony of these two, and I agree with you, one bill at a time, but I don't think we're going to have to go through this on every bill. We do have the conclusions down here, and I think the purpose is explanatory, but agreeing with you, perhaps we should stick to bill number one and get your comments on 2376. So as to your methods and how they track with NCCI.
Okay, in each of these fiscal years, I had about 95% of the time loss claims with a weekly wage, so I was happy to get a very good sample of how the benefits would increase. You note in 78-79, the time loss would increase 9.88 at 200% of the average weekly wage, drop to 9.19 at 166, and to 6.89 at 133. 79-80, the values were a little higher. It was 10.2, 9.6, and 7.3. And the second problem I had, as Mr. Lamb explained, was to find out how much is time loss of the total. And to do that, I had to resort to some manipulation of financial figures that we have. We try and compute our total liability by referencing the amount we pay in any one year and then factoring that up to an ultimate value. And I got very good figures for Medicaid time loss and PPD. Fatal and PPD I got by subtracting from a total, because those are done on a more hypothetical basis. You estimate how many PTDs you're going to have, and then you lay that much aside because you're not sure how many will develop. Fatals are pretty straightforward because they're usually in hand at the time you make your estimate.
Okay, let me kind of throw it open. So if I understand your, let's take the one and a third. Your figures for 79-80 at least, whereas Mr. Lamb has come up with about a 1.4% for everybody within that subset that you deal with your claimants.
I got somewhat higher.
Your people, you see it at just over 2%.
Well, here are some possibilities that would affect us. First, I had the opportunity to work with something beyond just the rate of increase. I had the amount of time loss actually paid over a rather long period. So that gave additional weight to those who drew for a long period of time. And secondly, of course, this is just safe experience. I don't pretend that this is universal for the whole state. It may or it may not be. Now, these two sheets you just have show the approximate distribution of an estimated liability for the two fiscal years. And time loss in 78-79 was 27%, and 79-80 was 28.4%. That, of course, has some effect on the final percent of pure premium increase that you noticed on the first page, where 78-79 it shows 2.67 for 200%, 248 at 166, and 186 at 133. And then over on 79-80, somewhat higher figures, but not too great. They increase.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Mr. Lamb, go ahead.
May I just say, first of all, that the numbers in the Workers' Compensation Department memorandum are not my numbers. They're
understand.
The National Council. And maybe I can explain a little bit more the difference. A couple of reasons would be that the way I explained that the council estimates the portion of total costs that are temporary disability types of claims. They use this model based on countrywide samples of claims, which seems to underestimate the, for Oregon at least, to understate the duration of temporary total and understates the portion of permanent partial claims that would be for the temporary disability portion. Also, they use this countrywide wage table, wage distribution table, which seems to be not quite as more compact than we are observing in Oregon. We don't have a very well developed wage table for Oregon yet, but the data we see seems to show that it's more spread out.
Okay. I appreciate those clarifying remarks. I think they are helpful, and I guess that speaks to another issue as to how we do try to reconcile the Oregon experience, if you will, within the NCCI model. And I think where you can show us where that fit is not perfect, that's helpful to us to understand those issues. I really want to thank you, Mr. Sutherland, for the effort that you put in here and your explanation. Representative Shiprock and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sutherland, it's been my experience on the committee that from certain testimony and experience that Safe Corporation also has a tendency to insure those employers in the higher risk, higher paying industries also. And would that not be reflected in your figures, which
yes, it could.
Would tend to shift,
right,
cause that disparity in rates or figures here.
We have a good bit of the construction and had a good bit of the logging.
Used to, yeah.
Yeah. I understand that.
Thank you.
Next issue. Okay. Well, Representative Johnson,
could you translate then your estimates, as I understand them, for example, would be that instead of 1.3, it would be 1.86 or even 2.07. Is that right? Somewhere
yes.
In that range.
Uh-huh.
Does this curve, if you wish, or trying to treat it as a curve, does this 81-80 or 79-80, 80-81, 81-82 period, does that continue to go upward because of the...
If you could give me more time, I'd like to get together with the data processing people and extract more recent data.
Do you think it is possible because of the increases in the
yes,
actual
I can
wage?
Find out whether the rate of increase goes up or whether it tails off.
Okay, later
in 81-82.
But those figures then translated are set as somewhere between what the NCCI says and what yours is the what the actual cost
very
to
large.
Oregon is.
Because as Mr. Shiprock said,
yeah.
We do have people who have higher average weekly wages than probably the average.
Can we translate this into, for every percent of overall cost increase, what does that represent in dollars?
Well, when we got the National Council's 1183 pure premium filing, I extracted 81-82 payrolls by class, and I computed the pure premium at each of the pure premium class rates, and I came up with $135 million. So if you start out with that and you assume that we have 37.2% of the business, which is what the mm-hmm. Workers' Compensation Department determined to be our percentage for 1981, that translates into pure premium cost of almost $363 million. And I noticed in one of the department's exhibits they used an expense loading of 1.237, which is high for us, but it may be the industry average. So that multiplies out to $449 million. Then if you add WCD's tax rate of 1.168, factor that in there, it comes up to about $524 million. So that means that every 1% increase in the pure premium rolls out into about $5.2 million, if all those hypotheses come together and are correct to begin with.
I see. $5.2 million per percent then. I guess so.
First, you see, there are a lot of assumptions. First, that the pure premium's right. Second, that the loading is going to be the average loading, which is probably going to be less than that. And third, that WCD is going to continue the current rate, which I've heard that they are not, that it would go up next year, testimony presented to you.
The load factor above pure premium, if you take the 237 and the assessment, assume 15 to 20%, who knows? So your load factor is anywhere from 38 to 42% above the pure premium, if you accept those assumptions.
One of our companies, the loading factor is only 0.49, and the other it's 0.234, which translates to 4.7% of manual and 19% of manual. So that's really not the values that we have here.
But then you lost 50-something million last year.
When you factor the pure premium, you have a small figure to work with, the expected losses. But after you factor, then if you want to say, okay, how much of this figure that I get is for expenses, then you have to relate to the larger figure, and the expense percentage then becomes smaller because you're dealing with a bigger figure than you started out with.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hamlin.
Mr. Sutherland, were you just talking about fiscal year or 1982?
I was talking about 81-82 fiscal year.
July 1st, 81 to June 30th, 82.
For the payroll. And then I used the pure premium as the 1183, the National Council file. And I multiplied the pure premium times the payroll to find out what the expected amount for that coverage would have resulted in losses if their estimates were correct.
How much did SAFE write? How many premium dollars did SAFE collect then in that fiscal year?
I'm not sure, because we summarize everything in terms of calendar years. I think around $115 million net in 82 after taking out the WCD tax. It was $137 million, you take out $22 million and it becomes $115.
And that was approximately 40% of everything written in the state?
About 37, maybe a little less than that. See, the premium that we collect isn't tied to the losses that we experience. And the losses are adjusted every year by changes in the requirement for previous year's loss, so you never can really pin a specific year down by looking at the annual statement. You've got to go to the fiscal year estimates themselves, or the calendar year estimates.
Thank you.
I guess.
Okay, well.
Unless you have more, I'd like to ask some questions.
I don't mind taking more questions. I want to point out we got about 40 minutes. If we're going to take any action on these bills, it's going to have to happen in about 40 minutes.
It doesn't matter what.
Representative Johnson.
In the subcommittee, there was some discussion of the historical wage and the spendable wage issue. Or the historical factors. I don't see any documentation that indicates that that has been considered. Have you been asked?
Yeah, I have a piece of information here.
Why don't you go ahead and start, Mr. Sutherland?
On this question, I just made a chart. I took $100 intervals and I took two-thirds of the average weekly wage, and that's the straight line at the top. And then I took the federal and state tax formulas, and the Social Security, and I computed what the time loss at 80% of the net would be for a single person married with a child and so on. And as you can see, as the weekly wage increases, the amount of time loss disparity between two-thirds and the 80% increases. They're very close at the bottom, then they tend to separate and get wider and wider apart. But I didn't attempt to translate that into percentages because I...
That's okay. We get the picture, I think.
Yeah. I thought that was far enough.
Okay, that historical wage theory, I guess, was presented as an amendment and part of the consideration of the subcommittee. Yeah.
So we've got, this is, so what we have here is the spendable issue.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Has anybody done anything with historical?
No, because nobody has specific data on that except the Department of Employment. They collect wage records by quarter. And you'd have to relate the date that the claimant files to his previous quarter's wages. And no payer, of course, has got that kind of information.
Now, you haven't had to deal with it before, I know.
Pardon?
You haven't had to deal with it before, I understand that. Do you think it's possible to put that together at all?
We don't have the material to do it with.
You'd have to make all kinds of assumptions, I guess.
The thing about Oregon's formula is that it's basing on the current wage, on the assumption that that's the annual wage, presumably. But no one has tried to find out what our claimants earn.
Do you think the information is out there? I'll just go from that.
It's,
can it be done?
What you'd have to do, Representative Johnson, is relate these claims to the Department of Employment's wage records and then go from there.
But it could be done.
It could be done, but it would take the cooperation of both agencies to do it.
Hey, they'll cooperate. They always do.
And I don't know whether it's legal for them to make that available, but it could be done. It's possible.
Okay. I think I'll ask that be prepared, and we'll ask staff to contact the Employment Division to coordinate that.
Could be
Since
done.
We're dealing with a benefit increase issue, it's got to be paid for somewhere. And so this is one way. If it's there, I don't even know if it's there.
Theoretically, I would expect that it would show a decline in the time loss amount because the present formula assumes that those people are working at that wage, the wage at which they're injured the whole year.
Will you contact staff then and proceed with this?
Okay.
Proceed with that. And I suppose if you can assist, why do so?
Mr. Chairman.
Assembly.
We had a subcommittee that was going to deal with these issues, and it's been working these things over for a while, and we've had the opportunity to gather all the information we wanted, and I'm ready to proceed on these bills either one way or the other. If we're going to deal with them, let's deal with them. If we're not going to deal with them, let's not. But the purpose of having the subcommittee and the hearings that you had, I thought, was to expedite the process for the full committee, and I'd like to proceed if we could.
Well, it's I'm awaiting a motion if there's a motion.
Representative Hanlon was about to make one.
Anytime.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
In regard to House Bill 2376, I would move that it be amended by changing the 200 on line 13 to 133 and a third percent of the average weekly wage.
Okay. And also where it appears on page 2, line 3?
There also, yes.
Okay. And such other amendments, if necessary, to conform to that concept. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Representative Hanlon moves that on House Bill 2376, where we state the maximum of the TTD to be calculated, where 200 appears in boldface as in the original bill, that 133 and a three-third be substituted.
Okay. I'm not going to
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
If I might just speak to this. And Representative Leak says the subcommittee had these duties. They did. We did. We didn't have the fiscal information we should have had at that point in time, and that's the purpose for taking up committee time this morning. I made the motion. Obviously, I support the motion. I think the fiscal shows a 1.4% increase in rates for the purposes of amending the bill, as I have so moved, and I will support it.
Okay. Is there further discussion of the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? Not the amendment's adopted. Is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I further move that we amend the bill to incorporate the AFL-CIO March 9th, 1983 amendments. You should have in your file a bill that has on page 2 typed in a subsection 4, and all that is for the coordination of information of existing law between unemployment and workers' comp benefits be communicated by the director to the worker via the determination order and any other means the workers' comp department may have that is necessary and proper. The subcommittee adopted this, and we ask that be included.
Okay, this is material that was distributed to members of the committee in a cover memo dated April 1st, 1983, and it includes the AFL-CIO amendments March 9, 1983. It includes a new section, subsection. Excuse me. And Representative Hanlon has so moved the inclusion of that new subsection 4.
Mr. Chair, I have no objection to the amendments proposed.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to that amendment? Not, it's adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move 2376 to the floor as amended, subject to LC review.
Okay, Representative Hanlon.
With a due pass.
House Bill 2376 to the floor as amended, due pass recommendation. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the Assembly. What am I saying here?
Just close.
I'm still about the Assembly. I am at that. I'm going to oppose these changes. It's very clear that the governor's made it brilliantly clear that he's not prepared to support changes in this process that increase the cost of workers' compensation without some comparable saving in the system. I haven't seen any bills that do anything to save anything in the system, and I see this step as one more step toward ignoring the reality that Oregon has a long way to go before it becomes perceived by anybody outside of Oregon as a good place to do business. I think we're, again, going right down the same old track, just as we have with plant closure and the rest. We're just making it less likely that we'll see the economic improvement that we badly need in this area. I don't think we should continue with this benefit program until some decision is made about how we're going to pay for it. And if it's going to come out in more premiums, I don't think it should be done. There's an escalator built into the system as it is. With the average weekly wage issue, it doesn't make sense to further escalate the costs by doing what's proposed. So I'll oppose the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
In response to the Vice Chair, I think we've all heard SAFE testify their rates are 46% of what they were 2 years ago. The governor of the state, as late as April 25th, has said that workers' compensation costs have been lowered by millions of dollars, estimating that the savings for employers is at the rate of $80 million per year in workers' compensation costs. I guess it all depends on how one looks at what point in time we begin the savings while injured workers are going with benefits that I consider inadequate. And I think if we start with the savings having begun and to the tune of a 54% savings, I think these types of bills are of minimal overall impact. But I do join the Vice Chair in looking for further ways to make the system more efficient, delivery of services, and adequate and full and fair benefits to the injured worker.
Assembly.
All I suggest is that Wednesday night we're going to be hearing up a couple of bills. I'm going to have the opportunity to do exactly the thing that Representative Johnson would like to do. And I'm not right. The two-way bills are up on Wednesday. Wednesday morning.
Not that I'm sure.
That's the opportunity to do what we all want to do, and I hope you'll join with us in supporting those.
Okay.
What bills are bigger? I'd like to know what he's talking about.
The two-way bills.
Two-way bills. Eliminate the private carriers.
I guess that's a matter of opinion.
I think we're going to hear a lot more about that one way or the other. Okay. Mr. Swanson, you'd had asked for an opportunity to testify. I don't know if you still want to exercise that now in light of the work session.
Well, I don't think it's necessary.
Okay. Thank you. I think we've had a chance to hear in subcommittee and full committee positions of the public. There's no further discussion. The clerk will call the roll.
Gold?
I'm sorry. Yes. Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Leak?
Aye.
Shiprack?
Aye.
DeBoer?
Nope.
Ford?
No.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. And Representative Johnson serves notice of a possible minority report. 2378.
Mr. Chair, I think it might, conceptually, now that we're on the average weekly wage, I think it might be better to take 2379 next.
2379. Okay. As you wish, 2379.
2379, to bring everybody up to speed on it, is the widow's bill. The subcommittee looked at this, and the recommendation of the subcommittee was not to amend the bill as originally printed in terms of wages received by the worker at time of injury, but to go back to and look at an increase in terms of the average weekly wage to the surviving spouse. And the subcommittee recommended two other amendments, and that was to bring the $5,000 burial benefit back down to $3,000, and the Representative Hill amendment, which did away with the 2-year requirement that a person be married to someone as a survivor